Okay, let's just look at verse 19. Verse 19. It is an asham. An asham. Now here is the... I think I have said that sometimes the guilt offering is called an asham. The sin offering is usually called katat. And the guilt offering is usually called asham. But those two offerings are very similar. And different opinions are available on what the difference between them is. Remember, I made the distinction that the sin offering was the general one, and that the guilt offering was the one where you could pay a penalty if you had damaged someone by your sin, or if you had damaged the Lord, as if you had not, for instance, given your tithe, or if there was something lacking in what you did for the Lord, then you could add a penalty and do whatever it was that you were supposed to do, and then you would have an asham. However, the asham and the khatat overlap some, even in terminology. So they're not particularly different offerings. Difference in one respect, but otherwise it's pretty hard to tell the difference between them. The names alone are not enough. So at the end of 19 there, it is an asham, been guilty. Asham, it is, he has been guilty of asham to the Lord. And verse 20, you have asham there three times in one verse, don't you? Short verse. Verse 20, and the Lord said unto Moses, spoke to Moses, saying, Nefesh, Nefesh tech. Nefesh here apparently just means person. Now, some people will translate nefesh usually as soul. You know, the soul that sinneth it shall die. It really is the person. Now, it is often the soul, but sometimes it is the person. Sometimes you translate it individual. I think there's one instance, though I can't give it to you offhand, where nefesh refers to corpse. A dead person, certainly, not soul. In that context. So, a person. A person, if he sins, and ma'al ma'al. If he commits a violation, the word ma'al is usually taken to be being unfaithful. It is some kind of a sin, but it's pretty difficult to tell exactly what kind of a sin ma'al is. It seems to refer a good bit to the sins of the worship, the ritual. But if he is unfaithful to the Lord, be unfaithful to the Lord in many different ways, that doesn't say much, does it? But that's what it's usually said there. The NIV translation there was, if anyone sins and is unfaithful to the Lord, and he deceives, lies to his neighbor, in something, pakad is, you know, means to entrust something. Pakad is to visit in the King James. Visit for good or visit for ill. In this case, apparently, the noun pekadon refers to something being entrusted to somebody. You borrow something. You borrow an ox. Well, the rule was, you know, if you borrow an ox, you pay back the ox, of course, but suppose you borrow the ox and the ox dies. Now, there's a law on that. The ox died, your fault, why you had to pay, but if it was just an accident, why? But then the question is how to determine if it was just an accident at all. It was in the laws, I think they're in Leviticus. So something entrusted to him, or in Summa, something that he has been given to him, and given to his hand. We are at such a disadvantage when we're dealing with ancient laws because we don't know all the differences in meaning. Now, here is something that is borrowed or something entrusted to him. But which is which? What is the detail there? In our modern legal language, you know, we have a law for a word for this and a word for this. Is it a misdemeanor or is it a tort or is it a felony? Well, a person from outside looking would know the difference. Those are the sharp legal distinctions we make. Obviously, the net result here is some animal that has been taken for one reason or another, in one way or another, in one contract or another, and defaults. And put in his hand is the word sum. Or if it is something stolen, or if it is something ashak means to oppress, or is something where he is, the king NIV says, cheated his neighbor. Cheat, I suppose, is all right, or what else? If he is extortion. Extortion, cheating, some way he has gotten the advantage over his neighbor. Maybe he encroached on his field, moved the boundary stone or something. Anything like that, you see. Now, these are various types of sin. Now, I may say this, that when you're dealing with laws in ancient Israel and with the ancient Near East in general, we have to remember that our law system is not always the same as everybody else's. We have to try to understand their law system, not just impose ours on them. We have a system whereby the law is written, and the judge determines whether or not the law has been violated, jury and all. And here is a man, and he borrowed something from his neighbor. And he shot the animal and couldn't return it, so he got mad and shot it. Well, the judge today would compare the act with the law and say, guilty or not guilty, and then give his decision. But the ancient judge didn't do it quite that way. And I believe still in Arab countries this is true, that the judge had more freedom than we do today. The man would say, I took this animal and it broke his leg. The owner says, it broke his leg and he's got to pay, it's his fault. And the man would say, it isn't my fault. Yes, he broke his leg, we know that. But he broke his leg because he kicked against something that was in the way. And it wasn't my fault. It was the animal's fault. The ancient judge would take all things into account and make his own judgment. He had the freedom to determine what was right, see. He didn't determine whether it fit the letter of the law, but he had the freedom to do what was right. And therefore, you didn't have to have a law that was totally complete. If you had just examples, that would be enough for the judge to go on. So here are examples of what might happen, where you would injure your neighbor. Here are four examples, or might be six more. The judge would determine whether he had injured his neighbor or not. See the difference between their jurisprudence and our jurisprudence. And I don't know that I would say that ours is better. It depends if you have good judges. We have the judges and we have the jury, and you know, the jury of their peers are supposed to decide. 12 good men and true, they say. But the 12 good men and true don't always do the right thing. So in the courts of law, why, you always have the problem of trying to get justice. And the ancient judge was given these laws and these examples, and he was to judge in the sight of God. He was to do what was right. And these laws were not intended to be, probably not intended to be complete. Or verse 22, or if he has found something that was lost, and he lies about it, the aved to be feminine abstract, something lost, and he lies about it. And or he swears on a falsehood, or one or from all the things which a man does to sin in these things. Here is the general statement. Whether it is lying, whether it is defaulting, whether it is injuring, whatever it is, all of these things that people do. Then if he is, it shall be when he sins, when he sins, then he shall return the asham, the thing that was stolen, which he had stolen, or the thing where he had oppressed, which he had oppressed, or the thing committed, which he had been committed to him, or the lost thing which he had found. This is the thing where he is guilty. He is guilty in any of these cases. Or from all of the things which Yishavah, which he has sworn against falsely. He shall repay it. This is the main point, verse 24. He shall repay it. Berosho, v'chamishi ve'av. What is that? Berosho, and in its fifth. In its head and in its fifth. What does the word rosh mean there? Sum. Principle. What's another word for it? Capital. Yeah, capital. The Hebrew uses the word head. We use the word capital, don't we? What does the word capital come from? Capital head. So, our word has the same semantic area that theirs did. So, you're right, the principle and the fifth. The fifth would be the fine. He shall add to it, to what his to what it was for him. He shall give it in the day of his asham, the day of his sin offering. And his sin offering he shall bring to the Lord. Ayil, a ram, perfect, of the flock. Now, be'er kakah is a difficult word. Most translations say, according to its valuation. And that probably is all right. But according to its valuation, it's kind of a technical term. And the technical term, again, is difficult for us to identify. Now, this has been studied by Dr. Spicer. I think the reference is in the commentaries. Dr. E.A. Spicer is a University of Pennsylvania professor for many years, and quite an expert in Assyrian law. And from the Assyrian law, he argued that this was a particular kind of a sacrifice, a particular kind of an arrangement, that it would be a lamb, according to its valuation, it would be a set value. A lamb would have to come up to the set value. A standard lamb, a standard offering. Now, of course, we don't know just what that standard would be, whether it would be a lamb so many years old, not more than that, you know. Not too tough, not too young. But it's that kind of a term, according to its valuation. Now, of course, it's a bait in there, but Dr. Spicer used to argue that the calf on the end was a hangover from old usage and is not to be translated at all. It's just according to the evaluation. Now, thy evaluation, you see, is what it says. That thy evaluation is the standard evaluation of people. So the according to its valuation, for an asham unto the priest, for a guilt offering unto the priest, and the priest shall make atonement for it before the Lord, and it shall be forgiven to him on account of one of all which he has done for an asham, for a sin offering for it. Yes, the priest shall make atonement for it. Now, I think we had discussed that sufficiently. And our claim was that he makes the atonement, and this is symbolic. The sacrifice itself does not make the atonement. The blood of bulls and goats don't make the atonement. As I said, even in Moses and Paul's offer, they could not make an atonement. No man can make an atonement for another person's sins or for his own sins. It must be a worthy atonement. Always, it says here, it should be perfect, a tamim. Atonement. And so our claim was that the Levitical offerings are indeed, just as the book of Hebrews says, symbolic of a perfect atonement to come. And you asked me, did they know that? And that's a big question. I claim that they do. I guess we would say that the different opinions on that, I believe it is fair to say that the dispensational school in general would argue that these offerings were brought as an expression of faith, and they believed that God would do it. They didn't know how, didn't have any idea how, but they trusted God, and they were saved through the sacrifices, but it was by faith in God. Now, some people feel that in the Old Testament time, being saved by law means, you know, they're saved by works. I don't think that's a fair interpretation of the dispensational view. A good dispensationalist would say they were saved by faith in ancient times, but they would not say that it was a faith such as the church has. It was a faith in God and in the sacrifices he prescribed, might call it a blind faith. And the distinction that the dispensationalists make, a strong distinction between the Old Testament time and the New Testament time, Israel were saved, some would say, one way, the New Testament saved another way. Now they would both, if you press them, say that they were saved by Christ. But the Old Testament people, according to them, would be saved by the sacrifices, the New Testament, by faith in Christ. Now, if you give them all allow them as much as possible, I would say that that the dispensational view is not heretical in this point. The emphasis upon being saved by faith is there. And when it says works, saved by works, it was the whole sacrificial system. In fact, they say that you have to consider both the ordinances and also the promises. And the promise of God to Abraham was unconditional, they say. That promise of God to Abraham being unconditional, that continues. And so they're not actually saved by doing the sacrifices. Some statements they make might seem that way, but they're not saved by doing the sacrifices. They're saved by faith and doing the sacrifices. Explanation is a testimony to that faith. Now, aside from the dispensational view, the fact that the question still remains, what did the Old Testament saints know about the sacrifices? And my claim is that they did know something. And I think we referred last time to Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53:10 actually says that the sufferer who dies in that passage, Isaiah 53, who dies, and his grave is with the wicked, and so on. It says, he is a sin offering. When you make my soul an offering for sin, the King James says, a guilt offering, I think the NIV says. So I would certainly hold that by Isaiah's time, certainly, the sacrifices were tied into the sacrifice of the coming one. One little point on Isaiah 53, you know, it begins in 52:13. 52:13, behold my servant. This is the last servant passage in Isaiah 53, beginning 52:13. In 52:13, he says, behold my servant, and the Targum, at that point, the Targum, you know, was the Aramaic translation of the days of Christ. The Targum at that point said, behold my servant, the Messiah. Evidently, the Jewish interpretation of Isaiah 53 at the time of Christ was that it referred to the Messiah, and that the Messiah would be a sin offering. Now that's saying a great deal. The It is commonly said that when Christ came, the Jews were expecting a king. Well, when people say that, I have to ask the first question, which Jews? I'm sure there were some Jews who were expecting a king to deliver them from Rome. But evidently there were other Jews who were expecting one who would be not only a king, but who would also be a sacrifice. And you have that very clearly in the Targum of Isaiah 53. So I think it is true that the Old Testament saint, more and more as time went on, but the Old Testament saint knew that the sacrifices were symbolic of a gift that God would give. And the gift that God would give would have to be, first of all, a perfect sacrifice, a worthy sacrifice. And as I said from the example of Abraham and Isaac, I say it would have to be more worthy than a human sacrifice. So I would argue that the Levitical instructions here do refer to a way of coming to God through a sacrifice that God would supply somehow. Abraham said, the Lord himself will supply a sacrifice. Jesus said, Abraham saw my day, rejoiced to see my day, saw it, was glad. So I would give the Old Testament saint more credit than some would do in understanding and interpreting these sacrifices. Maybe we can go just a little farther in the symbolism of the tabernacle. Tabernacle built in Leviticus, but we're dealing with the sacrifices of the tabernacle. In the tabernacle, of course, you have the Holy of Holies in the back with the ark and cherubim. And the presence of God is said to be here. And the question is, how do you come to God? How can a sinner come to God? And the answer is, he comes through the priest and through the blood and can come before God. But not without the blood. The priest must offer the blood on the altar out front, and in the solemn day of atonement must sprinkle the blood before the very, very holy place. And so the sacrificial system was not just something to give thanks for. It was a way to God. Way to God through getting rid of sin through the symbolism of the sacrifice. Have something to add to that? Any further questions that you might give? I think I would assume, as I said last time, that God had given some instructions about sacrifice even to Adam and Eve. But, of course, the full instructions are given here in the Leviticus passage. Yes.
Any questions?
The Targums? Yes. The Targums are not a unit. There are two Targums on the Pentateuch and different Targums on the Prophets. And they come, apparently, from the time of Christ, yes, or some before. There has been found a Targum on Job from the Dead Sea Scrolls written 50 B.C. And that was a surprise, because Job is not, you know, in the Pentateuch or one of those books, and even the Prophets. But there is a Targum on Job that is found. Our copies of the Targums don't come that early. I don't think I can tell you how early. The Targum of Omphalos, famous one on the Pentateuch, and the Targum of Jonathan on the Prophets. And there's a pseudo-Jonathan, and then there's individual Targums on individual other books, Psalms and so on. There are Targums on all books, but I don't know that they're given much value behind it, except for the ones in the Pentateuch and the Prophets. Although though this one, Job, now become very interesting. They were apparently, they were informal. A man would stand up and read the Hebrew, and then he would give a translation into Aramaic. And that translation apparently would be a free translation that a preacher would give. And later on, it was put down exactly when and by whom, not for sure. So those are the targums, and they are not too much studied by Christian people, too bad. I might add that in this passage in Micah, where it says, "Thou Bethlehem Ephratah, you know, not too greatest among the tribes of Israel, out of thee shall come forth the ruler who to me will be, one who to me will be ruler in Israel." Now, right there, one who will be ruler in Israel, it says the Messiah. It is named, in this case, a matter of rule. So when Herod asked the Pharisees where Christ would be born, they said in Bethlehem. This was actually a quotation from the Targum of Micah. Now, of course, you can get it from Micah without the Targum, but the Targum actually says that the Messiah will be born in Bethlehem. So they knew it. Herod knew it. Everybody knew it. Christ was born. Of course, when he said he was born in Bethlehem, Bethlehem is familiar and famous because it was David's city, the city of David. So the Targum there just makes clear what is clear otherwise, that this is one of the Son of David passages, or of the Son of David passages in the Old Testament. And Micah 5 is one of them, you see. The tent of David in Amos 9 is another one. And of course, the branch of David in Jeremiah and Isaiah, these are others. So they had a very definite messianic hope, but my point is that messianic hope was not just kingly. That messianic hope was also included in the prophets and by the Jews in Isaiah 53, which is a servant passage, a suffering passage, and indeed a passage of death and sacrifice. Actually, the word guilt offering is used there. No, what would you say about the average Christian today? Yes, we do. And still we have a fair amount of implicit faith.
Yeah, that's
today. Now, people know a great deal about the Bible, some not so much. So how much the Jews knew in Jesus' day, I would suppose that depended on the Jew. But their leaders, now, again, the leaders of today, if you follow some leaders of today, you would deny the Bible through and through. If you followed some leaders of that day, some leaders of the days of Jesus, you would be totally misled. At least that's what Jesus said. He said they're a den of thieves and a bunch of vipers. He called the religious leaders of his day, some of them. So there would be a variety. Those who followed the Pharisees would know nothing of what I'm speaking of. But those who read their Bible, and many did, just you might say the humble believer of ancient Israel would know that God was going to save their soul from sin and that the Messiah to come would do so. And if they would find read in their synagogues from time to time Isaiah 53, I say you don't read Isaiah 53 in the synagogues today. Isaiah 53 is not in the Jewish reading system, the Haftarah readings of the Jews today. I heard one time read the Talmud. You'll never find Isaiah 53 in the Talmud. And so I say that the ordinary reader who went to the synagogue and heard Isaiah 53 read, I would say that a lot of them did know. Now, when I say that they knew from the sacrificial system that the one to come would die for their sins, I don't mean that they knew in detail. They may have known he was born in Bethlehem, but there are a lot of things they didn't know. And so I say that there was a certain amount of ignorance, the natural ignorance of people who were just given a type and a shadow of what was to come. But that type and the shadow was sufficient for a faith that would trust in the Lord. I said, if you stop and think about it, we don't know all about the future either. And we have our ideas about the second coming of Christ and how it will be and what will take place, differences of opinion. The main things are true, clear. But the details are matters of debate. And I suppose it was true in those days. The main principles were clear, and people trusted in the one to come. But the details were obscure. Does that make some sense? Other questions? Yes?
Can you say more about the relationship with God and blood, and why the access to the presence of God is through blood and wine and the church?
Well, in Leviticus, 7, just turn to it, English. The Lord said to Moses, say to the Israelites, do not eat any of the fat of cattle, sheep, or goats. The fat of an animal found dead or torn by wild beasts may be used for any other purpose, but you must not eat it. Anyone who eats the fat of an animal from which an offering by fire may be made to the Lord must be cut off from his people. And wherever you live, you must not eat the blood of any bird or animal. If anyone eats blood, that person must be cut off from his people. Now that gives the law against blood, but doesn't say why. In 17:9, in both cases, you see, in both cases it says you must not do it because of the sacrificial system. You must not eat the fat because it's burned on the altar. It's holy. You must not eat the blood. It also is, it doesn't say, but that also is obviously part of the sacrificial system. But in chapter 17, in 17:9, any Israelite or any alien living among them who eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood and will cut him off from his people. For, this is Leviticus 17:11, for the life of a creature is in the blood, I've given it to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life. Now, the blood in atonement is obvious. But he says the blood in atonement is the item used for atonement because it represents the life. You drain out the blood, the life is gone. The blood is the obvious symbol of the life of the creature, or man or beast. And so he says that the blood, if you kill, you collect the blood. Well, the blood is the symbol of the life of the creature, and it is life for life. So I say the blood is the principle of substitution. We say that we're saved by the blood of Christ. Well, that's true. We're also saved by the death of Christ. Because the blood is shed, the life is gone. A person dies. So the life is in the blood. Now, of course, we know that the blood is not the only item of life, but it certainly is a necessary one. So I would say the blood is the expression of the life. Life, blood and life are taken as the expression of the substitution of the other creature, in this case, the lamb, for the person. And for Christ, Christ is the lamb, and the blood of the lamb of God is what saves our souls. When Christ shed his blood, he died. Does that make sense? I was objected to one time in class when I said that the blood is symbolic of the life. But I think that that's fair. The New Testament says faith in his blood. Blood is mentioned particularly, but it doesn't only say faith in his blood. It says faith in his death. Those things are interconnected, used equally in the New Testament. It is the death of Christ that saves us. It is the blood of Christ that saves us because when his blood was shed, he died. when we say blood, saved by the blood, we mean saved by the death of Christ. Yes, brother.
This prohibition in the Old Testament,
I think it's hard for us to imagine how shocked the Jewish people must have been when Jesus said, "I will give you my blood to drink." Isn't that right? When the blood, they wouldn't dare to eat the blood of an animal. And here this man says, "I will give you my blood to drink." No wonder some of them went home. Said many of them went back and went no more with him. And to eat my flesh, eat human flesh. And Jesus didn't, shall we say, pull punches. He repeated it. He repeated it, but then he said, "The words that I speak unto you, they are spirit and they are life." He wasn't talking about actually eating his or anybody's blood. He was talking about symbols. And symbolically, you must partake of me, he said. And of course, that's what the communion is. The communion is symbolic of his blood, and we drink the cup, as he says, "This cup is my blood which is shed for you." But it is, we drink it symbolically, we are partakers of Christ. As the Shorter Catechism says, not in a corporal and carnal way, but by faith, made partakers of his body and blood to our spiritual nourishment and growth in grace. The question of symbolism, of course, in the New Testament and in religion in general is a very interesting and important one. And C.S. Lewis has some interesting things to say on symbolism in his book on miracles, which I recommend you all to read. I suppose a number of you have read it. He says there that we talk in symbolic ways about God. And some people object to that. You poor dumb fundamentalists who believe that God is in heaven, that God comes down from heaven. And Russian astronauts go up there and they look all around. They don't see God, you know, so this proves there is no God. And C.S. Lewis remarks that the one who says God lives in heaven also says that God made heaven. That the Christian does not believe that heaven is just 5 miles upstairs. They didn't even before they had, you know, astronauts and all. It is a symbolic way of speaking of things. And so, we can't say the things about God in any other than symbolic ways, because our language is built on things we see and touch and so on. Spiritual things, according to C.S. Lewis, rightly so, spiritual things have to be given symbolically. The example he gives is when we say, I see your point, you have an argument. Yes, I see your point. Here's the point. Is that what we mean? When I see your point? Oh, well, no, that's not what we mean. You know, what I really mean is that, I grasp your argument. Well, which hand do you grasp that argument in, you see? Well, we talk, and our language is built on physical things because we are physical. But what we mean is something more than the physical. And when we say that that Christ came down from heaven, we don't mean that there is heaven is up here and up there, and he came down 9 miles or whatever it would be. We mean that Christ has come to us from heaven, the spiritual realm. And nowadays, they don't like say that. I read in theology books, they don't say that the kingdom of heaven came down or that Christ came down from heaven. They say God broke in. And they speak of the eruption of the kingdom of heaven. book, Eruption and Breaking In, does not picture God as up there and us down here. It pictures us as in a box and God breaking into the box. Now, if you prefer that figure to the other figure, okay. But notice that both of them are figures. Is that right? Because we just can't express the relation between spiritual reality and physical reality is something that's very difficult for us to get, and I'm sure we don't understand it. You have a soul that's spiritual. Where is your soul? Is it in your heart? Ancient times they spoke about the liver. Is it in your liver? My liver exults would be what they would say in ancient times. Is it halfway between your ears? Where is your soul? You see, that's a false question. Your soul isn't a where. Your soul is spiritual. It's not space-time. It is in personal, spiritual relationship to you and your body in a relationship that we cannot understand. I suppose angels understand it because they see it from the other direction. But it's hard for us to explain because we are space-time bound in language in so many ways. But in our language, we can have the concept of the spiritual and know the reality of the spiritual. But the spiritual is in a different level, different plane, different area. Different. When I say plane or area or level, why, they're all physical expressions. Dimension. Yeah. How do you measure that spiritual dimension? See the problem? And that is problem is for us just as much as for the ancients. Is it that the ancients were dumb and we know all about these things? So I say that the people in ancient times, conscious of sin, seeking a way to come before God, had a way given them to come before God. And God's presence was again symbolized by the ark. They came through the ritual of the priest and the sacrifice. And as they came through the ritual of the priest and the sacrifice, by faith they realized that God had forgiven their sins on the basis of something God supplied. And that something was symbolic of what would come. And they would be, and they were, in fellowship with the eternal God. And if you don't think that they were, could be in fellowship with the eternal God, read Isaiah. Isaiah is marvelous in his concept and expression of the relationship of the believer with God, but so is Moses. Well, these are things that come up, of course, from the ritual and the worship of the Old Testament time. And our claim is that the worship of the Old Testament time is very real, and that it was expressed in various ways, and one of those ways it was expressed was through the ritual of sacrifice, and that ritual of sacrifice included substitutionary atonement. But don't forget, there were other offerings too. It would have included also worship. As I said last time, the different sacrifices together give a picture of the work of Christ. And the work of Christ is many-sided, and for this reason there are different types of offerings. The worship would be expressed by the burnt offering and others, and the fellowship would be expressed by the fellowship offerings, peace offerings, and others. And the atonement would be expressed by the guilt offering and the sin offering and others. And I suppose it would say that the meal offering was part of the system, and it would also express fellowship as with others. So the Old Testament system gave a complete picture of the sinner coming into fellowship with God and living in fellowship with the eternal God and understanding something of his glory and holiness and power. I guess we might say that brings us to the priesthood. Any other questions on these different types of offerings? All right, Major. Yes.
Thinking of the relationship between faith and works and everything.
Yeah. I have something to say on that. It's off the subject directly of our class, but I think it bears on the subject. So wait 10 minutes and let me say something about faith and works.